There is a certain kind of modern mystery that begins not with a hidden cave or an old map, but with a little bottle on a convenience store counter. You see it once, maybe in a photo, maybe in a video, maybe in someone's account of their day. It has a name that seems almost too smooth, too friendly. Feel free. A small blue bottle, marketed as a wellness tonic, a plant-based drink, something that sits in the blurry zone between supplement, mood enhancer, and lifestyle product. It is not presented like a hard drug. It is not presented like alcohol. It looks more like something you might buy near the register after yoga class, or at a health food store, or from a gas station cooler next to energy shots. And then you hear somewhere that some people are drinking several of them a day, not one now and then out of curiosity, not one at a festival or after work, several a day, every day, and the mind does that little quiet calculation it does when trying to determine whether a thing is real or merely overrepresented. Is this actually happening? Are there really a meaningful number of people doing this? Or is this one of those internet mirages where three posts, one trip report, and a few dramatic comments combine into the feeling of a trend? It is a strangely difficult question to answer, because when it comes to substances, especially newer or semi-legal ones, our sense of scale is often distorted. The internet has a way of making fringe experiences feel common, and common experiences feel invisible. One person can write with such intensity that their story seems to stand in for thousands. Meanwhile, thousands of quieter people may be using something casually and never saying a word. Or thousands may be struggling, but privately, because shame tends to be a poor broadcaster. So you end up trying to read shadows, a Reddit thread here, a YouTube comment there, a recovery post, a trip report from someone who is also using other substances, which complicates everything, a warning label, a news article, a lawsuit, a company statement, a friend of a friend, a photo of a display case at a gas station. It becomes a kind of folk epidemiology, where you are not really measuring prevalence so much as gathering weather signs. And still the question remains, is this a real thing? The short answer seems to be, yes, it is real, though probably not in the sense of being a vast mainstream epidemic. There do appear to be people who use Feel Free heavily and regularly, and some who describe dependence, withdrawal, and difficulty stopping. It is not just one or two people in the country. At the same time, it is probably not something most people have even heard of, let alone tried. It lives in that middle region that modern substances often occupy, not imaginary, not universal, not fully understood. The more interesting answer has to do with why something like this can take hold at all. Feel Free is usually discussed because it contains, or has contained, kava and kratom. Those two plants carry very different cultural histories, though in the American supplement marketplace, they can get folded together into a single vague promise. Relaxation, sociability, ease, a little lift. Kava has a long history in Pacific Island cultures where it is traditionally prepared from the root of Piper methysticum. It is often consumed communally in rituals and gatherings, and its effects are usually described as calming, grounding, lightly euphoric, sometimes numbing in the mouth. It has its own set of risks and controversies, especially around liver health, preparation methods, extracts, and heavy use, but it is not usually thought of in the same way as opioids or stimulants. Kratom is different. It comes from Mitragyna speciosa, a tree native to Southeast Asia. Its leaves contain alkaloids, most notably mitragynine and 7-hydroxynitragynine, that interact with opioid receptors, among other systems. People use it for many reasons: pain, energy, mood, anxiety, opioid withdrawal, focus, or simply because it feels good. Its legal status varies by place. Its supporters often describe it as a lifeline. Its critics warn about dependence, withdrawal, contamination, variable potency, and the risks of treating an opioid-like plant as if it were just another tea. Kratom is one of those substances that sits uneasily between categories. It is not quite treated like a conventional drug, but it is not simply a harmless supplement either. It has a foot in folk medicine, a foot in gas station commerce, and a foot in the neurochemistry of dependence. That ambiguity matters, because when something is sold as a shot, a tonic, a botanical drink, or a wellness product, it arrives surrounded by softer cues than, say, a pill in a baggie. A small bottle feels manageable. Its branding may imply balance rather than intoxication. It may be placed near caffeine shots or kombucha or adaptogenic drinks. The ritual is easy. Unscrew, drink, go on with the day. And if the effect is pleasant but not overwhelming, that can make it easier to underestimate. The first experience might not be dramatic. It may not feel like getting high in the way people expect. It might feel like the rough edges of the afternoon have been sanded down. A little warmth, a little verbal ease, the email you were avoiding becomes less aversive, the body feels less burdened, the mind softens. There is a quiet danger in substances that do not announce themselves loudly. A dramatic drug experience can scare people. A gentle, reliable, socially compatible effect can become part of the furniture. You wake up tired, you have one, you have a meeting, you have one, the day is heavier than expected, you have another. It becomes less like partying and more like adjusting the light in a room. And because the bottle is small, and the name is reassuring, and the purchase is ordinary, each instance may not feel like a major decision. This is one of the ways dependence can grow in low light, not always through recklessness, but through repetition, through an effect that is useful enough to return to, mild enough to justify, and short enough that returning becomes convenient. The price is an interesting part of it. From what many people report, these products are not especially cheap. Depending on where and how they are bought, a habit of several bottles a day could become expensive quickly. That fact can make the whole thing seem implausible at first. Who would spend that much on little bottles every day? But substance habits have never been governed by ordinary budgeting logic. People spend startling amounts on cigarettes, alcohol, cannabis, energy drinks, delivery coffee, nicotine pouches, lottery tickets, prescription copays, and all kinds of small recurring comforts. A $10 habit repeated daily becomes visible only after time has passed. A $20 or $30 habit can hide inside a person's financial life for a while if it is meeting some immediate need. The future cost is abstract, the present relief is not. And if someone is already used to spending money on substances, or if they are in a stressful period, or if their life has narrowed in certain ways, the arithmetic can become stranger still. The mind discounts the recurring cost because the day in front of it feels more urgent than the month behind it. There is also the matter of tolerance. A person might begin with a partial bottle or one bottle and notice a distinct effect. Over time, the same amount may do less. This is common with many psychoactive substances. The body adjusts, the baseline changes, the thing once used to feel better may become something used to avoid feeling worse. That shift is subtle, and in many accounts of dependence, deeply disorienting. At first, this helps me relax. Later, I don't feel right without it. At first, this gives me a nice lift. Later, I need it to feel normal. People often describe this transition only after they are on the far side of it. While it is happening, it may simply feel like a busier week, a slightly higher stress level, a reason to use a bit more. The narrative catches up late. This is one reason trip reports can be both illuminating and misleading. A trip report is a little window. It tells you what happened to one person, in one body, in one context, on one day with one batch or dose or combination. But substances rarely exist alone. The person may have slept badly. They may be drinking alcohol. They may be taking antidepressants, benzodiazepines, stimulants, opioids, cannabis, or other supplements. They may have tolerance from prior kratom use. They may have an anxiety disorder. They may be unusually sensitive. They may be exaggerating or underplaying or simply interpreting through their own expectations. If someone says they were drinking several feel-free bottles a day, but they were also using other substances, that does not make the report useless. It just means the bottle is part of a larger weather system. It may be a main cloud, or only one current in the air. Still, when many separate people describe similar patterns, escalating use, expense, cravings, withdrawal-like symptoms, difficulty stopping, that becomes harder to dismiss. It does not prove a precise prevalence, but it suggests there is a real enough phenomenon. One thing worth sitting with is how the word addicted gets used in these conversations. Sometimes people use it casually. I'm addicted to this drink, meaning they enjoy it or crave it in a mild way. Sometimes they mean physical dependence. Stopping leads to symptoms. Sometimes they mean psychological compulsion. They keep using despite wanting not to. Sometimes both. With kratom-containing products, many heavy users do report withdrawal symptoms when they stop. Anxiety, restlessness, insomnia, sweating, gastrointestinal upset, body aches, low mood, irritability, and a general sense of being unable to settle. The exact experience varies a lot, and dose matters, frequency matters, duration matters, and the person's history matters. but it is not hard to see how a product that contains kratom could become dependence-forming for some people. That is consistent with what is known about kratom itself. The novelty is not that kratom can be habit-forming. The novelty is the format, the small branded wellness shot, pre-mixed, portable, socially ambiguous, and easy to incorporate into a day. A loose-leaf powder has a certain roughness to it. It tastes bitter. It requires measuring, mixing, tolerating sludge. Capsules require counting. Tea requires preparation. A bottled shot removes friction. And friction, small as it seems, can be protective. Many habits depend on ease. It's like the difference between owning a bag of coffee beans and having a little button that delivers espresso to your hand whenever you pass the kitchen. The substance may be the same in broad category, but the ritual changes the pattern. There is a whole anthropology in packaging. A glass of whiskey has one cultural meaning, a tiny airline bottle has another, a can of hard seltzer has another, a prescription bottle, another, a vape pen, another, a gummy, another. Each container tells the user how to think about what they are doing. It whispers, "This is medicine. This is recreation. This is wellness. This is normal. This is edgy. This is discreet." The feel-free bottle from the outside seems to whisper something like, "This is a tool for being more at ease." That may be why the stories bother people. There is a mismatch between the gentle promise and the harder accounts. A person expects a wellness tonic and then reads about someone spending hundreds of dollars a week and struggling to stop. The dissonance is unsettling. To be fair, not every person who tries such a product will have that experience. Many may drink one occasionally and never think about it again. Some may dislike it. Some may use it for a period and stop. Some may find it helpful and not escalate. Human responses are uneven. It is easy and concern to flatten everyone into the worst-case story, but it is also easy and dismissal to flatten everyone into the casual user story. The truth tends to resist flattening. One person's harmless novelty is another person's trapdoor, and often the difference is not moral strength or weakness, but a complicated mixture of biology, circumstance, prior substance history, stress, pain, sleep, loneliness, money, availability, and the particular way a given compound fits a given nervous system. There is a phrase people sometimes use, "It scratches an itch I didn't know I had." That phrase has always seemed quietly important. Some substances do not simply add pleasure, they reveal a felt absence. They make a person think, "Oh, this is what I was missing." Calm, energy, warmth, social ease, relief from pain, a pause in self-consciousness, a sense that the day is not pressing quite so hard against the ribs. Once a substance provides that, especially reliably, the memory of the relief can become powerful. The brain is very good at remembering solutions to discomfort. It does not always distinguish between a wise solution and a costly one. It remembers what worked. And a lot of ordinary life contains low-level discomfort. Not dramatic suffering necessarily, but a thin static. Fatigue, obligation, minor dread, boredom, loneliness, bodily tension, a sense of being always slightly behind. A product that promises to smooth that out is not entering a neutral marketplace. It is entering a world full of people trying to get through Tuesday. This is perhaps the larger context. We live among countless small regulators. Caffeine in the morning, alcohol in the evening, screens in every gap, nicotine for focus or relief, melatonin for sleep, cannabis for decompression, sugar for mood, exercise too, music, hot showers, snacks, scrolling, prayer, breathing, shopping, flirting, cleaning, gambling, working. Some are healthier than others, but they all participate in the same basic human project, changing state. We are creatures who modulate ourselves. The question is not whether people will seek altered states. They always have. The question is what tools are available, how they are framed, how honest the culture is about their trade-offs, and how easily a person can notice when a tool has become a tether. With products like Feel Free, the unsettled feeling may come from the sense that the framing is still catching up to the pharmacology. If a drink contains a substance with dependence potential, then botanical may be true but incomplete. Plant-based may be true but not reassuring in the way people assume. Many potent things are plant-based. Opium poppies are plants. Tobacco is a plant. Coca leaves are plants. Coffee is a plant. Plants are not gentle by default. They are chemically inventive. There is something almost charming about our recurring surprise at this. Humans keep rediscovering that nature is not synonymous with mildness. Nature is full of alkaloids, toxins, sedatives, stimulants, attractants, repellents, and complicated negotiations between organisms. A plant does not produce psychoactive compounds for our lifestyle balance. It produces chemistry because chemistry is one of the ways life bargains with life. And we, curious mammals that we are, taste the chemistry and build rituals around it. Sometimes the rituals are stable for centuries. Sometimes they are compressed into a product cycle and placed on a shelf before the social wisdom has had time to form. That may be the oddest thing about newer commercial substances, the speed. Traditional use often includes constraints, preparation methods, social norms, times and places, elders, taboos, shared expectations. Commercial use strips many of those away and replaces them with branding, convenience, and price. The bottle becomes portable tradition without the tradition. Kava in a communal bowl is one thing. Kratom leaves chewed by laborers in a particular region, in a particular rhythm, are one thing. A concentrated bottled shot sold broadly to people with no cultural map is another. Not necessarily worse in every case, but different enough that old assumptions may not apply. When people ask, "Is this really happening?" part of what they may be asking is, "Has a whole new little dependency niche opened up while I wasn't looking?" And probably yes, in a modest but real way. Modern life is very good at creating niches. A product does not need to reach everyone to create a meaningful pocket of harm. A small percentage of users, if the user base is large enough, can still be a lot of people. And even if the absolute number is not enormous, it matters intensely to the people inside it. There is a temptation to settle the matter by choosing one of two stories. Story 1, panic. The product is dangerous, predatory, everywhere, and anyone who tries it will be hooked. Story 2, dismissal. It is just a fringe internet thing, people are exaggerating, and only irresponsible users have problems. Neither story is very satisfying. Panic often makes people less precise. Dismissal often makes people less compassionate. A calmer story might be, "This appears to be a real pattern for some users, especially with frequent use, and it is plausible because of Kratom's pharmacology, the convenience of the format, and the way the product is marketed and consumed." The scale is uncertain. The individual risk varies, but the reports should not be waved away just because the bottle looks benign or because the habit seems expensive. Expense, after all, does not prevent dependence. It may only add another layer of distress. If you listen closely to accounts from people who feel caught in a habit like this, the emotional tone is often not wild pleasure. It is weariness. They may describe planning the day around supply, hiding purchases, feeling ashamed of the cost, waking up anxious, promising to taper, failing, trying again. There is a familiar narrowing. The world becomes organized around maintaining a state that used to arrive as a bonus and now feels like rent. That narrowing is one of the quiet signatures of dependence. Not just the presence of a substance, but the shrinking of options around it. And maybe that is why even observers with no personal stake feel unsettled. They sense how easily a little convenience can become architecture. How a small bottle can begin as an accessory and end as a daily checkpoint. At the same time, it is worth leaving room for uncertainty. We do not have perfect public data on every branded supplement habit. Online communities can cluster people with bad outcomes, making problems look more common than they are. People who use occasionally without issue are less likely to post long accounts. Media stories may focus on extremes. Legal disputes and advocacy groups may emphasize harm. Companies may emphasize responsible use and customer choice. Everyone has a lens. So the honest posture is neither certainty nor ignorance. It is something more like watchfulness. You can say, "I don't know exactly how common this is, but I know enough to believe it is not imaginary." You can say, "A product can be legal, branded, and sold openly, and still be capable of causing problems." You can say, "A person using multiple bottles a day is not automatically representative, especially if they are using other substances too, but their experience may still reveal something real about the product's risk profile." You can say, "The existence of casual users does not erase dependent users, and the existence of dependent users does not define every casual user." That kind of balanced thinking is less dramatic, but it tends to be more useful. There is a small scene I keep imagining. Someone walking into a store in the late afternoon. The light is low. The day has become a little frayed. Maybe they are tired, maybe a little anxious. Maybe they have a drive ahead of them or a few more hours of work. They see the bottle. It is small. It promises ease. They buy it, drink it, and for a while the world loosens. There is nothing obviously catastrophic in that scene. No sirens, no collapse, just a person trying to soften the day. Most habits begin in ordinary scenes like that. This does not make them harmless. It makes them understandable. And understanding may be the gentlest way to think about it. Not alarm, not mockery, not naive reassurance, just an attempt to see the forces at work. Chemistry, marketing, stress, convenience, hope, tolerance, money, secrecy, repetition. If someone is worried about their own use of a kratom-containing product, or someone close to them, it is sensible to treat that concern as real, rather than waiting for it to become dramatic. Dependence does not always look dramatic from the outside. Sometimes it looks like errands, receipts, irritability, and a private bargain repeated too many times. Medical professionals, addiction specialists, or support communities familiar with kratom can be helpful, especially because stopping suddenly after heavy use can be uncomfortable, and for some people, complicated by other substances or health conditions. But even without turning this into advice, the broader lesson is worth carrying. The surface of a product is not the whole product. A friendly name is not a pharmacological category. A plant is not a guarantee. A small bottle is not a small effect if it becomes part of every day. And an internet rumor is not always just a rumor. Sometimes it is the first sound of a pattern that has not yet been measured well. So is it a fringe thing? In one sense, probably. Most people are not drinking multiple feel-free bottles a day. Many people have never heard of it. It is not woven into ordinary life like coffee or alcohol. But is it only one or two people? No, almost certainly not. There are enough reports and enough biological plausibility to say that a non-trivial pocket of people have used these drinks heavily and struggled with them. The pocket may be small relative to the whole country, but not small to the people inside it. There are many phenomena like this now, algorithmically magnified, commercially distributed, unevenly regulated, personally intense. They hover at the edge of mainstream awareness. For some, they are nothing. For others, they become a chapter. Maybe the best closing image is not a warning label, but a shelf. A shelf in a store, holding dozens of little promises: energy, calm, focus, sleep, confidence, relief. They are brightly packaged, or softly packaged, or wrapped in the language of plants and balance. Each one suggests that a human state can be purchased in a portable serving. And, in a way, that is true. Humans have always purchased states. We buy coffee, tea, wine, chocolate, tobacco, music, vacations, incense, warm bread, soft blankets. We are always negotiating with our nervous systems. The question is what each bargain costs, not only at the register, but over time. Some costs are mild, some are hidden, some only appear after the thing has become familiar. And so we look at the little bottle with a kind of quiet curiosity. Not terror, not contempt, just curiosity, with enough caution mixed in to keep the image clear. A small blue bottle, a large set of questions, and somewhere many ordinary people trying to feel a little more free than they did a moment before.